The outbreak of the Great War had been signalled not by the stroke of a pen or a single fateful pronouncement. It had taken place like a train smash in which coach after coach had run without braking into a huge pile of wreckage. Driven by the impetus of their treaties of mutual aid, Austria had declared war on Serbia, Germany had declared war on Russia and France, and finally, on the 4th of August 1914, Britain had declared war on Germany. The fire and smoke that Lucima had foreseen had spread out to envelop the world. Once more, the population of the newly united South Africa was divided. Louis Botha was the former commander of the old Boer army, and his comrade-in-arms, General Jannie Smuts, had fought at his side against the combined forces of the British Empire. Most of the other Boer leaders hated the British, and were strongly in favour of joining the conflict on the side of the Kaiser's Germany. It was only by the narrowest margin that Louis Botha carried Parliament with him and was able to send a cable to London informing the British government that they were free to release all the imperial forces in southern Africa because he and his army would take over the defence of the southern half of the continent against Germany. Gratefully, London accepted his offer, then asked if Botha and his army could invade the neighbouring German southwest Africa and silence the radio stations at Lüderitzbucht and Swakopmund, which were sending a steady stream of vital information to Berlin detailing all movements of the Royal Navy in the southern Atlantic. Botha agreed immediately, but in the meantime, bloody revolt was brewing among his men. Botha was only one of three former Boer leaders and heroes known as the Triumvirate. The other two were Christian de Wet and Hercules Cous de la Rey. De Wet had already declared for Germany, and all his men went with him. They were holed up in their fortified encampment on the edge of the Kalahari Desert, and Botha had not yet sent a force to bring them in. Once he did, rebellion would break out in full force, and the ravening beasts of civil war would burst raging from their cage. Although de la Rey had not come out openly against Botha and Britain, nobody doubted that it was only a matter of time before he did so. They did not suspect that he was awaiting news from Germany on the flight of the Assegai from Wieskirche to his succour. This news would be sent from Berlin through the powerful radio installation at Swakopmund in German southwest Africa, just over the border from South Africa. In Wieskirche, the Assegai was taking on her final cargo. Graf Otto von Mirbach and Commodore Alfred Lutz struggled all night with the loading manifest. Much of the calculation was a matter of guesswork and instinct. No man alive had experienced flight in an airship over the Sahara Desert during the summer months, when air temperatures could range from 55 degrees centigrade at noon to zero at midnight. The Assegai's total gas volume was 2.5 million cubic feet of hydrogen, but daily she would be obliged to valve off large volumes of this to compensate for the weight of fuel she was burning. Otherwise she would become so light that she would go into an uncontrolled rush to upper space, where her crew would perish from cold and lack of oxygen. The main tanks were filled to the brim with 549,850 pounds of fuel, 4,680 pounds of oil, and 25,000 pounds of water ballast. Her crew of 22 men and one woman, and their severely restricted personal luggage, weighed 3,885 pounds. Theoretically, this allowed a useful cargo of 35,800 pounds to be taken on board. But in the end, Graf Otto decided to abandon 7,000 pounds of mortar bombs to make way for additional gold bullion. That would be the weight to swing the arms of the scale in their favour. All the coin had been struck in 18-carat gold. There were almost equal amounts of authentic British sovereigns and Deutsches Reich 10-mark coins. The money was packed first into small canvas bags, which were placed in sturdy ammunition cases, the lids securely screwed down. The final tally was 220 cases. Each case packed with coin weighed 110 troy pounds. This was the usual pack carried by an African porter on safari. Historically, gold was always valued in American dollars, and it had been fixed at $21 per fine ounce for decades. Graf Otto was quick with figures. The value of his cargo in round terms would be $9 million, which, despite the current chaos in the exchange markets caused by the outbreak of war, was the equivalent of £2 million sterling.
That should be enough to keep the Boers smiling sweetly for a long time to come.
He personally supervised the baggage handlers as they packed the chests in neat rows down the length of the main salon of the assegai and lashed each one to the ring bolts in the deck. On top he laid the cases of live ammunition and the crates of Maxim machine guns. By the time the last had been secured, there was little space for the crew to move around the airship and attend to their duties. In an attempt to alleviate the problem, Graf Otto ordered that the bulkheads between the cabins be taken out and the bunks removed. The crew would be forced to sleep on the wooden deck. He had the chart and radio rooms knocked down, then moved forward to the control gondola under the bows. Three latrines were stripped out to make extra space. Only one remained to provide for the needs of 23 people. There was to be no differentiation between the men and the woman, the senior officers and the Lascar cook. The laundry was dispensed with and the galley halved in size. A small electric stove would be enough to heat soup and coffee and turn out a pot of porridge each morning, but there would be no other hot food. The milk would be powdered, sausage, cold meat and hard biscuit would make up any shortfall. He would allow no alcohol on board. It would be a bare-bones ship, stripped of all but the necessities. The last dinner before departure was a banquet held in the assegai's shed under the massive silver bulk of the airship. At the last moment, one of the Mirbach limousines, driven by a uniformed chauffeur, brought Eva from the Schloss. She was wearing her flying gear, with boots, gloves, and a goggled helmet. The chauffeur carried her valise, which was all the luggage she had. Until she arrived, the crew had not known she would be travelling with them. Her beauty and charm had made her a universal favourite, so they gave her a hearty welcome. Henny Durant had not seen her since the voyage back from Mombasa on the SS Admiral. Rough and graceless man of the soil that he was, he bowed and kissed her hand. His companions hooted with glee, and he blushed like a schoolboy. Eva was touched, and felt a pang of guilt that she had deceived him with her pretense of not understanding what had taken place during his meeting with the Boer general. When Graf Otto called her, she went to join him at the head of the dinner table. He introduced her as the expedition's mascot. The company clapped and cheered. They were happy and excited, eager to set off on a journey that they knew would be considered an epic of airship travel. The plates were piled high with Bavarian delicacies. Only the liquor was stinted. Graf Otto wanted clear heads and eyes on board when they took to the skies. The toasts were drunk in a light pilsner, in which the presence of alcohol was barely detectable. At 2100 hours precisely, Graf Otto came to his feet.
"Azo! My friends! It is time we were on our way to Africa!"
There was another burst of cheering. Then the crew hurried aboard and stood to their action stations. The ship was weighed off carefully, then walked out to her mooring mast. Standing in his makeshift radio room, Graf Otto made final contact with Berlin Central. He received the Kaiser's personal good wishes and was told Godspeed. He turned off the transmitter and gave the launch orders to Commodore Lutz. The assegai slipped her nose cable, rose gently into the golden summer twilight, and turned onto a heading of 155 degrees. Over the past weeks they had planned the flight in detail, so there was little need to discuss it now. Lutz knew precisely what Graf Otto required of him and his crew. Showing no lights, they ascended to their maximum safe cruising altitude of 10,000 feet as they floated over the Bodensee and ran on due south to cross the Mediterranean coastline a little after midnight, a few miles west of Savona. They went on southwards, keeping the lights of the Italian coastal towns in sight on their port side. They had a strong following wind as they crossed the island of Sicily, which carried them swiftly to their landfall on a nameless, bleak stretch of the Libyan desert somewhere west of Benghazi. As the sun rose, Eva stood at the forward observation windows of the saloon and watched their gigantic shadow flitting across the ridges and dunes of the rugged brown terrain below. "Africa," she exulted silently. "Wait for me, my love. I am coming back to you." The heat came up at them. Sunlight reflected by the rock and powerful eddies swirled around the ship like the currents of some great ocean. She was lighter now that her four great Meerbach engines had burned off 6,000 pounds of fuel and oil, but the sun heated the hydrogen in its chambers, increasing their lift. Inexorably, the airship began to rise, and Lutz was forced to valve off 230,000 cubic feet of gas, but still she continued to climb until at 15,000 feet the crew felt the enervating effects of oxygen starvation. At the same time, the temperature climbed dramatically and was soon registering 52 degrees centigrade in the control room. The engines had to be shut down in rotation to allow them to cool and for fresh oil to be pumped through the systems. They were now flying light, with 6 degrees of down angle on the controls. The airspeed bled away from 100 knots to 55, and the assegai was failing to respond adequately to the helm. Then the forward port engine surged and cut out. With this sudden loss of power, the airship stalled and dropped from 13,000 to 6,000 feet before she responded to her helm again and came back on even keel. It had been an alarming plunge, and part of the main cargo had broken loose. Even Graf Otto was shaken by the assegai's erratic behaviour in the superheated air and agreed without argument to Lutz's suggestion that they should land and anchor the ship for the remainder of the day to continue the journey in the evening. Lutz picked out an outcrop of black rock on the desert floor ahead that would afford an anchor point for the mooring cable and eased the ship downwards, valving off great quantities of hydrogen. They were only 50 feet above the desert floor when a party of mounted men in flowing white burnous burst out from the rocks and galloped down a wadi towards them, brandishing curved short swords and firing up at the assegai with long-barrelled jezails. A bullet smashed through the observation window beside Graf Otto and showered him with glass. He swore with annoyance and stepped across to the Maxim machine gun mounted at the front of the gondola. He levered around into the breech, then swung the gun downwards on its mounting. He fired a short burst, and the leading rank of charging Arabs disintegrated. Three horses went down, taking their riders with them. He traversed the gun right and fired again. Four more horses dropped, kicking, into the sand, and the survivors scattered. Eva counted the casualties. Seven men were down, but two horses lunged back onto their feet and galloped after the rest.
"I don't think they will be coming back," he said casually. "You can stand the watch down until 1800 hours, Lutz. Then we'll start the engines again to fly on in the cool of the night."